Anyway, I think we're going to get more detail on this now from our next speaker, who's come all the way from Aotearoa, New Zealand, Jane Kelsey. And I'll give you a little background on Jane. Jane is one of New Zealand's best-known critical commentators on issues of globalization and neoliberalism. She's taught at the University of Auckland since 1979. Jane's active internationally as a researcher, analyst, advisor, and media commentator on globalization, especially the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, trade in services, and investment agreements. She is an active member of a number of international coalitions of academics, trade unionists, NGOs, and social movements working for social justice. So please welcome Jane Kelsey from New Zealand.
Kia ora koutou, ki ngā tangata whenua o tēnei wā, tēnā koutou. From Aotearoa, from New Zealand, I'm really pleased to be here, and I first want to pay my respects to the First Nations of this place. I'm going to stand up, if that's okay with the film people, because I've got a really bad cough, and it's worse when I sit down. So if I'm going to get through this, then it's probably better if I stand. I also tend to wave a lot. I was here last for the APEC meeting in Honolulu in 2011. And I want to start from that point in terms of the big picture of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. Shortly before that meeting, Hillary Clinton had published an article where she talked about America's Pacific Century. And it was going to have a dual pivot. One pivot was moving the military presence of the US from Iraq and Afghanistan through back into the bases throughout what we call Asia, what is called the Pacific by Clinton. Now, of course, that didn't necessarily work. They've spread themselves back over both zones. But the clear intention was that the US was going to reestablish its presence as a superpower in the region. The second of the pivots was to be economic, and it was to be the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, where the interests of US corporations and the rules designed by and for those corporations would become the prevailing ethos throughout the Asia-Pacific region, not only amongst the existing parties to the agreement, but by other countries docking on to the TPP, or what we call the TPPA. We call it the TPPA because it's not a partnership. It's an agreement. And we refuse to use the con words, just as we refuse to describe it as a trade agreement. It's not a trade agreement. It's a commercial agreement that is designed by and for the interests of big business. Why was Clinton talking about this dual strategy? Because it was the means of neutralizing the ascendancy of Asia, of China in the region, and it was what we called a kind of Cold War by proxy of commercial agreements. The agreement had, by the time Clinton was talking, already been under formal negotiation since March 2010. That means now 5 years since that first round of negotiations. They currently have 12 countries involved in these talks taking place in the Marriott on this island. And if you think about it in an arc, you have Canada, US, Mexico, the NAFTA countries, Peru, Chile, Australia, New Zealand, Singapore, Brunei, Malaysia, Vietnam, and Japan. You have two elephants in that room. Canadians probably think they are as well, but they're actually a minion. The US and Japan. And you have a lot of very small, poor countries. Well, Vietnam's not so small, but it's poor. And you have countries that do not have leverage in these negotiations. You may want to ask, why are they there? We ask that quite often of them as well. But it is clear that these negotiations have an agenda that is driven by what we have come to know since the global financial crisis as the 1%. It is not surprising then that it is shrouded in a veil of secrecy. When they started the negotiations in May 2010, after Obama had thought about whether he wanted to continue with what Baby Bush had already committed the US to, they made a secrecy agreement amongst themselves. They said no documents relating to these agreements, whether they are emails, whether they are where the meetings are being held, whether they are papers that have been tabled or the draft texts, will be released until 4 years after the agreement has come into force or 4 years after they have suspended the negotiations. So all you will get to see is the final agreed text, not any of the background papers during the negotiations, and not any of the background papers for 4 years afterwards, which is when those who did it still have power. So we won't be able to hold to account the governments that made these deals until those governments are not formally the ones who are still in power. However, of course, and especially in the US, some people get to see these agreements. So those who are the cleared advisors, who are in the US context predominantly the corporations, can not only get to see elements of the text of relevance to them, but they can get to make demands about what they want in that text. There are a number of members of the US Congress who have objected to the fact that they did not even have access to the text on the same basis as the corporations. Now they do, but when they go in to look at it, they can't take pen and paper. They can't take anyone with them who might understand what the legal terminology means. They can't tell anyone what they've read once they've left the room, which means that there is no point whatsoever in them actually seeing the text. In my country, in New Zealand, the members of parliament don't even have that access. Now, this is a real worry because any deal negotiated in secret is problematic. And the reason for secrecy is that they know if it is subjected to the disinfectant of daylight, it will not survive. There have, as Juliet said, been leaks, and in fact there's been many more than that one. The leaks have been coming out. We've had about 5 leaks of the intellectual property text, a number of leaks of specific additional ones on medicines. We've had the investment chapter leaked, we've had the environment chapter leaked, and we've had a chapter on regulatory coherence leaked. And all of those give us enough to know that this is a deal that should not be being negotiated. As a consequence of that, there is a major mobilisation occurring across the countries, and I'm going to refer to a few examples of that at the end. But let me spell out a little bit for you what some of the issues might be for you as Americans. Because we are told quite often, not only that Americans completely support agreements like NAFTA, and this is NAFTA on super steroids, but that it is being pushed by a range of American interests, not simply the corporate lobbyists of the banks and Hollywood and the mining companies, but it is also being pushed by the unions and the environmentalists and so on. Now, what we know from looking at these texts is that that actually is not the case. And we know that from working with a number of those working for social justice within the US. We know that when they talk about this agreement, as they do, as being an agreement for the 21st century, it is the 21st century of the 1%. It is not our 21st century. It is making rules that they describe as going further behind the border in putting disciplines on governments than any previous agreement has ever done. That means putting the handcuffs on future governments to be able to act in the interests of people in confronting the challenges of the 21st century. Those challenges are issues like climate change, financial instability, job insecurity, a whole range of realities that we know have to be confronted, and where governments' choices about those regulations will be constrained in different ways. Now, let me just give you a handful of examples. And some of them are new. The issues are not new, but the techniques are new. And I'm a lawyer. I'm not going to bore you with the legal details. But I know in the US you have a major issue about jobs and offshoring. And the more that the internet and what is called e-commerce has expanded, the more those threats have intensified. There is a chapter in the agreement called the e-commerce chapter, which will aim to have rules that say, if there is a company that is doing stuff by the internet, you can't require it to have a local presence in your country. If it relies on moving data across the borders, whether that's information about you and your debts or your health or your insurance, they can't be required to hold that information inside your country, which means privacy law. I know you've got not many privacy laws, but if you want to tighten up your privacy laws in the state, for example, your ability to demand that that information is held here and subject to those tighter laws rather than somewhere else that doesn't have those laws, you'll have problems. If you want to be able to insist that data isn't held in places where the state has surveillance powers over all your information, you also have problems. The e-commerce chapter we actually had a leak of, not in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, but in a twin agreement. And I need to explain to you that this is one of three terrible triplets. We have this 12-country agreement, where the US is the lead player. There is a second mega agreement between the US and the EU called TTIP, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. And that also has the US, but in this case, the EU battling out. And the third is another four-letter acronym called TISA, the Trade and Services Agreement, which is an agreement amongst 23 parties where they're trying to get out of the problems in the World Trade Organization and develop a global trade and services agreement. Now, services is all those mega players. And what the US is doing is making exactly the same demands in the three. And so we have a leak in the TISA agreement of the e-commerce chapter. And that is up on a website in the EU. If you Google TISA e-commerce leak, you'll get it in an analysis that I did of that. And it shows what these threats are in the e-commerce area. Right? And if you're worried about what that is going to mean for your jobs or your privacy or your ability to control shonky money flows and so on, then you need to be aware that that is one of the new phenomena. A second new area is not new in itself, but it's new because of the context that we've all confronted since 2008. The global financial crisis exposed how big banks and insurance companies operate, and how those speculative flows flow around the world with an industry that claims it's too big to fail. That is too big to be regulated. Well, rather than going and working out how to re-regulate, it is going to lock in and extend that light-handed, risk-tolerant lack of regulation of the finance industry in the TPPA, in TTIP, and in TISA. So we need to be really worried about how that instability that we saw before is going to play out in the multiple new crises. Which leads to the third of the issues I wanted to refer to, and which is what Juliet was talking about, with the special rights of foreign investors in this agreement. Now, some of you who are familiar with NAFTA will know that already in NAFTA, foreign investors from those three countries, US, Canada, and Mexico, have special rights not available to local firms. And they have a couple of particular rights, not only about their right to invest, but special investor protections. If governments change the laws or the regulations in ways that impact negatively on the profits, including future profits, or the value of that investment, and they think that that is unfair to them, in particular if it changed the rules after they made the investment, they can seek multi-million and in some cases billions of dollars damages for their losses. And ironically, this is called fair and equitable treatment. And the cases are brought not in our domestic courts, but in these secretive offshore tribunals, in which the judges are not proper judges. They are predominantly people who are lawyers representing investors one week, judges in these cases the next week, and back representing investors the week after. There are no effective conflict of interest rules. There is no system of law that applies. They make up the law for each of their cases. It's not like our system of precedent where courts are bound by previous decisions. There is no appeal. They take place largely in secret. They are making outrageous awards, and the number of disputes since 2000 has increased like this. We now have law firms chasing these cases. We have private equity and hedge funds basically leasing the cases, running them, taking the profits as if they were a financial commodity. They are out of control. There is massive global controversy about this. But they will be in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. We know that from the leaked investment text. Interestingly, in TTIP, the US-EU one, Germany and France have said they will not have it in that. But the US requires it in all its agreements. Why won't Germany have it? Germany is subject to two disputes at present from a Swedish investor called Vattenfall. One is over closing nuclear power plants after the Fukushima disaster, and the second is on climate change mitigation policies that it adopted after the Stern report. There's a whole series of other hugely controversial cases. In Australia and New Zealand, Philip Morris Tobacco Company is challenging the plain packaging of tobacco, seeking $1 billion from Australia in one of these tribunals. And New Zealand has backed off introducing plain packaging until the dispute from Australia is known. In Canada, there is a US mining company that is challenging the moratorium on fracking in Quebec. It is also, there is a Eli Lilly, a US drug company, is challenging a decision of the Canadian courts to deny it a patent because it didn't satisfy the legal requirements of Canada. There's a dispute in Egypt where a case is being brought by a contractor because the Egyptian government did a number of things, including changing labor laws and increasing the minimum wage. There are cases where corrupt contracts have been closed down and they have been challenged by the contractor. Now, all of these things, and I have to say, the US has never lost one of these cases, but don't believe it's not going to happen. And in particular, shonky, this is a Kiwi term, shonky, bad US firms, investors, can go somewhere else and through the back door come in and use these arrangements when they couldn't use them domestically. Right? Now, if for no other reason, that is a reason to challenge all of these agreements. And many countries now are seeking to withdraw from them. South Africa and India and Indonesia. And here we are signing up to more of them. And of course, financial regulation in a financial crisis, same thing will happen with the banks and the financial speculators, the insurance companies and so on. So let me just conclude by saying what is happening with the negotiations now. After 5 years, almost all of the technical work in the 29 chapters, it's that big, are concluded. Except for the really controversial political decisions. But the ministers from the different countries are not prepared to make those political decisions until the one old-fashioned trade issue of market access is resolved. The US and Japan are talking about how much agriculture products the US can get into Japan and about Japan lowering its environmental standards for gas-guzzling US vehicles. And Japan is demanding more access for some of its vehicle exports into the US. And they are at stalemate. And they have been for a while. They had a ministerial meeting that was supposed to take place this week. That's why it's a fancy resort. But it's got deferred until April, and we think it might even be deferred until May. But they have a deadline. If Obama is going to have this agreement as part of his legacy, he needs to have an agreement by the beginning of June. So we view our current task as making sure there is no agreement by June, not only by hoping that the two elephants can't reach agreement, but by putting enough pressure on our domestic governments to say that they cannot do this. Our friends in Washington are fighting a grand battle to stop fast track, to make sure that other governments are not going to be prepared to sign up to a deal that the US Congress, with all the lobbying interests, can pull apart. And they are also looking closely at another dirty little practice that the US administration uses called certification, which is right at the end of the negotiations, when you think you've done everything you need to put the agreement into effect, the US comes back and says, oh, sorry, what you think is required of you isn't what we think is required of you, so you need to pass this new law and that new law and that new law. And we have evidence that shows in relation to some countries not only requiring new laws to be passed through the USTR before the local parliament introduces it in their country, but the US writing the other country's laws, the US sending people down to monitor those laws in their capital and make sure no amendments are made, and saying it's not just what's in the written text, it's what you said to us you'd do in the room, or in some cases, what you said to us you wouldn't do in the room. And if the legislature does not pass that, going back to them and saying, you need to do this now, or there is no agreement. Now, that is all causing a lot of worry, even amongst the chief negotiators. Because a final deal in June is not going to be a final deal. It's going to be a deal that the US Congress is able to play with. So what we are doing internationally is a range of campaigns at a global level. There are a number of websites that have really good information on them, and for your interest, the Public Citizen website is the one that has the most information. We're also having lots of domestic actions. In New Zealand last Saturday, we just had a National Day of Action. We have 4.5 million people in New Zealand, whole country. We had over 10,000 people out on Saturday in 23 different towns and cities across the country. They calculated on the basis of per capita in Japan, that's about 1 million people in Japan. Our government is having to take notice. That kind of action is happening in other places as well. The medicos, there are big health issues here about prices of medicines and big impacts, which I haven't gone into. But the medical people from seven of the countries just had a letter published in The Lancet, the iconic medical journal, including by the head of the Global Public Health Associations, by the head of the medical associations in various countries, saying the secrecy is unacceptable, there needs to be a cost-benefit analysis of the impacts on health before any decisions are made in these negotiations. We've got legislators in various countries saying this is an outrage against democracy. We're having a whole range of people, you know, from economists led by Stiglitz and Roderick and others about the financial regulation and capital controls through to environmentalists and trade unionists and so on. So there is a really big international campaign, which is also spreading to the other two big agreements, the US-EU one and the services one. And so we need you in Honolulu, and you in this island, to be adding your voice to that. And it's great that you're going to have such a visible presence on the weekend, because there actually are some negotiators who aren't too keen on this either. And it not only sends a message to your government and to our governments, but it also sends some kind of moral support, paradoxically, to them to stay strong. So in Aotearoa, we have a little fighting saying. It's called Ka whawhaito no mato ake, ake, ake. We will fight until the end, forever and ever and ever. Kia ora.